I'm Bridie Cruz. Anti-Israel activists blockaded airport traffic across the country, including in Seattle, and Attorney General Bob Ferguson apparently found his voice to speak out about it. Plus, it happened. An infamous Seattle teacher may have finally gone too far. And how taxpayer funds are being used to sell voters on the Climate Commitment Act. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support this little show of ours for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. And welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. Man, we told you, right? Hate to be the one that's like, told you so. We knew. I mean, in Seattle, the activists are completely emboldened. And when you give a mouse a cookie, they get away with something. They keep building it up and they keep doing worse and worse stuff, more disruptive and more disruptive. So yesterday we were on, we were talking about elsewhere. I think on the East Coast, this started before it started yesterday on the West Coast and the rest of the country. So we were talking about Chicago O'Hare. There were anti-Israel demonstrators who were blocking the airport there. And then by the time we were off the air yesterday, it was happening all across the country. And this was coordinated, and law enforcement should have known full well about it, because I saw after the fact some flyers that were going around that said, we're going to have this national movement. There's all these cities that have agreed to participate and to block airports. And so that included SeaTac Airport. Como News reported on this at the time. I mean, there were people walking with their bags. They blocked the one of the roads into SeaTac Airport. And so what happened is once it went on for long enough, because we already know in this state, law enforcement can't do what Florida did when this happened yesterday and just pick up the people, haul them off and throw them to the side of the road, which was also a little bit hilarious. But here it takes forever, apparently, to clear protesters from block. We saw in Seattle took 5 hours when they were blocking I-5. So according to Como News, 46 pro-Palestinian protesters arrested for blocking the road to SeaTac Airport. But because they always, you know, they'll find these weird creative ways to link themselves in concrete and their hands in these tubes. And so they anticipate, although I don't know why they anticipate in Washington state that police will move them, because we've seen that police just are told by politicians to look the other way or to just ask them really, really nicely to leave. And in this case, though, I don't know if they were anticipating that police would try more aggressively after the backlash over I-5 to move them off the interstate. But, you know, they had all the, oh, we're not going to let go and we're not going to move. And so you've got police coming in and trying to get them off the interstate. It took a while, though. There was a little citizen alert for people in the area. It's sort of pilots walking, you know, had to get out and walk away. And then eventually police were able to move the protesters over to the curb and handcuff them. 46 is a pretty good haul. I will say 46 is a pretty good haul for a Seattle area protest. They did it also more quickly than what happened on I-5. And again, I think that the political pressure and the embarrassment of, you know, the criticism of the state patrol, the criticism of Seattle officials and state officials after the blockade on Interstate 5, I do believe had a little bit of an impact on their willingness to go a little more hands-on with these demonstrators to get them off the freeway. But here, I'm going to read you something that'll make you so mad. So mad. You know who said something yesterday about the protesters and the blockade? Would you look at this? Bob Ferguson, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, on his campaign Twitter, of course. Attorney General Bob Ferguson called it unacceptable. He said our roads and transportation facilities must be open for Washingtonians and emergency vehicles. I appreciate the response by law enforcement working to clear this important access to the airport. Well, isn't that something? Bob Ferguson, who had nothing to say when protesters, these same exact protesters, blocked I-5 for 5 to 6 hours. Nothing to say at the time. It's also interesting because when he says, I appreciate the response from law enforcement working to clear this important access to the airport, roadways must remain open for emergency vehicles. There were ambulances stuck in the I-5 blockade back in January. Bob Ferguson didn't say anything about that. And when he was cornered by Como News at an event, to ask about the State Patrol response, he said, well, I'm not going to give my opinion. You know, they're our client, and this isn't my place to comment on that. Well, apparently it's his place now. It's his place now that he's in a hotly contested race for the governor's office, and he's getting very, very concerned about his track record on public safety issues and his track record of absolutely never speaking out about the far left insanity and rioters and protesters. I mean, did Bob Ferguson say anything when there were anti-Semitic demonstrations on the campus of his alma mater at UW? Nope. Did he say anything when rioters looted downtown businesses to the studs in the summer of 2020 and lit cop cars on fire? Nope. Did he say anything when rioters took over six square blocks of the city of Seattle as the state's chief law enforcer? Nope. What's different now? Oh, that's right. He's running for governor, and he's starting to realize that there is actually a chance that he could lose. And so now he's trying to appeal to the vast majority of Washingtonians who think things like this are certifiably insane. And I said earlier, I hate to say I told you so, but back when the blockade happened in January, I think it happened on the 6th, and so it was on the three-year anniversary of the siege on our nation's capital. And at the time, Bob Ferguson had plenty of time to speak out about January 6th, 3 years later on the anniversary, but no time in the world to condemn in real time what was happening on the interstate in Seattle. And I said at the time that this isn't a surprise. This is a slow, gradual outcome for letting these protesters get away with all sorts of stuff over the years. And I even said at the time, what's next? What are they going to do after they blockade the interstate? Here are some clips. You let them shut down a Christmas tree lighting. They're emboldened. You let them shut down a bridge. They're emboldened. You let them take over six square blocks of a city. They're emboldened. Why would they not believe that they can take over an interstate? And what are they going to do next? What's bigger than that? They have completely been emboldened. Governor Jay Inslee, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, you know what they were focused on that day? Well, it was January 6th. They were focused on condemning an act of domestic terrorism that happened 3 years ago. And they were also focused on the UW Huskies and their championship football game and putting out tweets about that. Do you think that they said anything about this over the weekend? No. Silence. So again, no consequences, no condemnation. And we wonder, well, why do they think they can do this? Because they can do this. They have done this. Politicians have allowed this environment. Politicians have emboldened activists to believe that they can do this and get away with it. Politicians like Bob Ferguson, who now, because he wants to be the governor, is trying to rewrite history and act as if he's not okay with things that he's been completely silent and complicit on. For years, we saw this just a couple weeks ago when he came out with King 5 and he announced his public safety plan and said he never supported the rollbacks on police pursuits. And we reached out to his office and said, what do you mean? He never said anything about that publicly for the past 3 years. Now, all of a sudden, now that it's been repealed with an initiative, he's saying, oh, I never supported it anyway. Well, how convenient. So we tried to press him to provide proof that he told anyone at all, that he wasn't in support of what his fellow Democrats did on police pursuits. And what do? They sent Nicole an email saying they'd never respond to a request of ours ever again. So no, Bob Ferguson, you don't get to get away with for 15 years saying nothing about the acts of criminal civil unrest. And then all of a sudden, when you're running for governor and you have a very strong public safety opponent, you get to say, well, this is unacceptable. Yeah, it is unacceptable. What's even more unacceptable is it took you this long to say something. I'll also say that there was an effort in Olympia this past legislative session to make stuff like this a felony. Now, it would have applied specifically to people who are organizing organizing demonstrations that block transportation or infrastructure for transportation. So roads, bridges, etc. Representative Peter Obarno said, and this was a Republican bill, House Bill 2358. However, it did have just a couple Democratic supporters. But even with that, as Obarno points out, House Democrats refused to hear the bill. It would have made it a Class C felony with a $5,000 fine to be an organizer of people obstructing highways. So even with a bill that, and this was put out right after the I-5 ordeal, And so you had a couple Democrats who were willing to sign on, but not enough for the House Democrats to prioritize it. So if this is truly unacceptable, as Bob Ferguson now says, who's trying to be the standard bearer of the Democratic Party, does he also think it's unacceptable that Democrats wouldn't strengthen laws around this? Would he support? Nicole, let's reach out to Bob Ferguson's office and his campaign. Even though they told us they're not responding to us anymore, we're still going to reach out. Ask him if he supports that bill. Would he support bringing that bill back up for consideration? Because if he finds it unacceptable, I don't see why in the world he would not. I did ask a subscriber poll on this, and I'll get to it later on in the show, about what you think the punishment should be, how stiff the punishment should be for doing something like this. But you're talking about blocking airports. How is this not a federal crime? Is it because it's not on a federal property? I mean, I feel like it should be a federal crime to go in and disrupt air travel. And God, I felt so bad. I'll tell you what, I'm going to Florida in a couple weeks. You don't want to see me. You don't want to see the rage that I would have if I were in one of those cars that was stopped on my way to SeaTac Airport. I think I would have taken care of business on my... I think Mike would have taken care of business on his own. He would have physically removed some people from the interstate and just tossed them off to the side. Yeah, if you try to ruin my Florida vacation, I can't be held accountable for my actions, because I would have been certifiably insane in that moment. And so I just have to wonder, I mean, first of all, you're not getting anyone over to your cause doing stuff like this, obviously, but hopefully that woke up some liberals. Hopefully that woke up some Democratic voters who were trying to get to the airport to go on vacation or whatever it was. 46 people arrested. So a lot of that's going to be failure to disperse, I imagine. So we'll have to see how serious the charges are that they're facing. I think it's terrorism, honestly. You're blocking bridges, blocking major highways, blocking access to an airport. How is that not terrorism? It should land them in federal prison. And until we start treating it with the seriousness that it demands, they're going to continue to do these sorts of things. Because getting arrested for failure to disperse, they're willing to take that for the cause. Yeah, we'll do that for the cause. Felony? Classy felony or a federal prison time? I don't know if some of these, what does Cho call them, soy boys, would be willing to do that for the cause. Speaking of soy boys, I want to take you to the Seattle Public School District. And we have what I have to say is a semi-positive update on infamous teacher Ian Golosh. So Ian Golosh, if you're new to the show, we've talked about him a lot because he's a teacher high school teacher in the Seattle Public School District, and he's just a professional activist. And there have been documented instances of him acting completely inappropriately going back at least 4 years, and I'm sure well before that. And then, as we said on the show last week or the week before, I thought, he's finally done it. He's finally gone too far. He has to have. This has to be enough for the Seattle Public School District to fire him. And it was when he said this on camera to a entity called, is it Accuracy in Media? Yeah. I think that's it. Let's play the clip. So you guys will be familiar with it. Just revisit it.
Your post said that their oppressors don't get to choose the form of resistance used against them. You didn't write that?
That is true.
Well, then was what happened to Israel on October 7th justified?
Yes.
The rape of women at a music festival was justified.
Where's the evidence that there was rape?
You don't think there was any rape?
Where's the evidence that there was rape?
Okay. Were women murdered at the music festival?
They were.
Was that justified?
Yes.
The murder of innocent women just attending a music festival, that was justified in your opinion?
No. I think resistance against Israel is justified, yes.
You see how I never noticed in that video, but you see how he starts to move toward the reporter, like trying to intimidate him? Because Ian Golosh is a big guy. So that was interesting. So anyway, that video went crazy all over the country, and there was understandable backlash. And one of the things we said is, you can't keep that teacher. Said that it was okay to murder innocent women at a music festival, and that rapes didn't happen when there's clear documented women have come out and told the stories about being raped. How can that person be allowed to be in a classroom, in a public school, paid for with taxpayer funds, in a school where there are Jewish students, hell, in a school where there are female students? I wouldn't want my female daughter going to school where there's a teacher who denies clear instances of rape and brutality against women. So I said, that's got to be it. And it seems like his activism is finally catching up with him. So our friend Jason Rantz got a couple tips that Ian Golash is on leave and has been on leave since school got back in session from spring break. And now Seattle Public Schools is hiding behind it, so we don't discuss personnel issues, which is ridiculous. But they gave Jason Rantz a statement. I'm going to read it for you in full. It says, Seattle Public Schools does not tolerate anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, or any kind of hate speech or acts in our schools or offices. Again, we're not talking about Islamophobia. They just have to put that in there. We're talking about anti-Semitism. The description of a conversation occurring between an Accuracy and Media member and an SPS teacher on April 1st is deeply concerning. And again, the description of a conversation? Have you not watched the video? You don't need to rely on anyone's description of the conversation. Just watch what he said. They went on in their statement to say, the statements we observed from a teacher, oh, there it is, do not represent Seattle Public Schools. We are conducting an immediate, appropriate investigation to determine the facts. While our review is in process, we cannot comment on personnel matters related to this topic. Creating high quality and inclusive educational environments for our students is a top priority for SPS. We are looking into this matter, and once our investigation concludes, we will provide an update. So, based on sort of some of the information Jason was being fed and this statement, it sounded like, and I think I heard from some people were saying they were trying to call the school and get like, oh, is he in there and couldn't be connected to him? So anyway, Ari Hoffman got an even bigger clue. Remember I told you that being a left-wing activist is literally in Ian Golash's blood? Because when I was sleuthing on his Facebook, it linked to his dad's Facebook, and his dad was talking about how he's a socialist and involved in all these things, so apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Well, Ari Hoffman just tweeted out, Mike Golash, the father of Seattle Public School teacher Ian Golash, confirms that his son has been placed on paid administrative leave after it was revealed that he denied the October 7 rapes committed by Hamas. Yeah, so his dad, Mike Golash, had commented on a news story saying Ian has been placed on paid administrative leave for the rest of the semester for speaking out against genocide in Gaza. He has been told not to speak to any students or teachers in the Seattle school system. Yeah, one would hope. But again, I love how his dad frames that. Paid administrative leave for the rest of the semester for speaking out against genocide in Gaza. No, there's a lot of people who have spoke out about what they see as genocide in Gaza that doesn't even come close to resembling anti-Semitism. What your son did is deny rape. What your son did is suggest that women deserve to be brutally murdered at a music festival because they were Israeli. What your son did in that clip was not speak out against genocide in Gaza. So, Mike Golash, you're giving us a lot of insight into why your son is the way he is and why your son shouldn't be able to set foot back in the Seattle Public School District. I know that the WEA, the Washington Education Association, is strong, probably the strongest entity in the state of Washington, but I don't even think that they're that strong to make sure he keeps his job, but we'll keep an eye on it. So wanted to give you that update. All right, coming up next, there's going to be a bus rolling through Seattle that says unvax on it. And we're going to tell you what it's all about. First, I've talked about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. We're about 2 months away from summer. So if you're thinking you'd like to cut some weight, you're just not looking and feeling your best. I lost about 30 pounds on the program in my first 2 months. Those results are not atypical. A lot of people lose 20 to 30 pounds on the program. It's not magic. I know that sounds like magic. It's not. It is difficult. You have to really stick to a routine and you have to make sure that you're following the program. But if you do, the results are so fantastic that it gives you a lot of motivation to continue. I'm down nearly 40 pounds total. So if you'd like to check out the program, see what it's all about, I recommend you just schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. I'll tell you, it's the best 15 minutes I have spent on myself. Probably ever. All right. There is a bus it's an RV. Yeah, RV. Traveling across the country, talking about some of the negative outcomes from the COVID vaccine, which some people refer to as COVID injuries, which is a real thing. I mean, there's so many things around the COVID issue and pandemic that were denied, you know, whether it's, oh, it's bad for kids to be out of school. Nah, you're a conspiracy theorist who wants children to die. Or, hey, the COVID vaccine isn't actually stopping the spread. Yes, it is. Oh, wait, it's not. But we're still going to fire people if they don't get it, etc. So now I think we're getting to the point where more people are willing to have open and honest dialogues about what we went through during the pandemic, about the vaccine issue, and trying to prevent some of the mandates and lies and lack of accountability that happened on that issue. So Children's Health Defense, which was actually founded by RFK, was it founder? He's the leader of Children's Health Defense. So they have a bus, I can show you a picture of, it says Vax on Vax. And it's going across the state of Washington. It has three stops starting today. Today, actually, as we speak, it's at the state capitol in Olympia. It's going to be there until 2 p.m. So Bob Runnels is the Washington chapter leader for the Children's Health for Children's Health Defense. And he's on the Vax on Vax bus. And he joined us on his way to Olympia to talk a little bit about what they'll be doing. You're on an RV right now. You're on the Vax on Vax RV. Heading to Washington State, what's going on?
It's an epic traveling memorial, as we're calling it, because of all the signatures on the outside. It's a developing memorial as we have vaccine-injured people come and tell their stories, or even those with hospital protocol issues during the COVID pandemic. They can sign the bus. They sign the bus as an epic memorial to really, we want people to know that vaccine injury is real, yeah, and that laws should not be mandating, and that in general, the right to refuse should be respected.
So talk about, when you talk about vaccine injuries, and are you specifically referring to children, or are you opening that up to adults as well who have had issues with the vaccine?
Adults as well. It's pretty much any hospital protocol and vaccine injury story from a childhood schedule shot or from COVID pandemic shots, or even we've got quite a few adults who took, say, a flu shot or something like, there's even one person who can't make the bus because of her disabilities. She had an MMR shot in 2019, but won't be able to do the interview. She'll do one later study. And all these interviews, I'll just add real quickly, are going to roll up into a documentary.
Now, Spokane is probably fine, but you roll up in an RV that has to do with, you know, questioning vaccines in Olympia or Seattle, two of the most progressive areas of the state. Do you not anticipate some issues with that?
Well, I would say it's just really sad if anybody wants to come out and heckle us. But I will say that people need to know. We just hope to make sure that people understand that vaccine injury is real and that we should not be forming public policy about forcing these products on anybody.
Yeah. And who will be with the RV besides you? I mean, do you have like a medical professional or anyone who's there that can talk to people if they show up to the RV?
If they show up, we do have some interview slots, right? So on the RV, we'll mm-hmm. be conducting 15-minute interviews where people can tell their stories. And we record those, and those are actually live streamed to the chd.tv website.
Gotcha.
And we will have some empty interview slots where people could walk up, potentially, and tell their stories. So we are encouraging people, though, to go to the website for Children's Health Defense, look up the People Study, and click on the Contact Us form, and send your story in. You can request a formal time. And we'll schedule that. We'll schedule those times beforehand. We prefer to schedule beforehand.
Yeah. So again, that's Bob Runnels. He is the Washington chapter head for Children's Health Defense. And he's on this Vax Unvax bus, which I'll get to the schedule for that in a moment. But if you want to watch our full interview, we'll also be looking at this from a medical perspective and vaccine injuries coming up this Sunday on Sundays with Subscribers. You can sign up undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. So basically, if you have a vaccine injury story that you want to share as part of the documentary that you're putting together, you can either schedule, you know, sign up for a slot or try to just do kind of a walk on the RV bus and sit down and talk to them about what happened to you or what happened to a loved one or a family member. It doesn't just have to be vaccine related issues. Maybe it has something to do with hospitalization or something you experienced in the medical realm during the COVID pandemic. So they're again, today they're at the State Capitol Olympia as we speak until 2 p.m. And then the brave souls are taking that bus up to Westlake Park in Seattle. tomorrow, and they're going to be there basically all day, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then on Friday, they're going to be in Spokane, and they're going to be there basically all day as well. They're going to have some interviews scheduled and some speakers, so basically 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. So if you're interested in stopping by and talking about, you know, your experience, you can do that, or you can watch Sundays with Subscribers and learn more about this sort of mission that we're on, they're on, because it extends beyond just vaccines and what happened during COVID, but other issues in the medical industry that they feel like people need to ask more questions about. And be more informed about. So we'll have that conversation coming up on Sundays with Subscribers. I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge because I just honestly think every single person, first of all, needs someone to walk them through the complex insurance world right now, especially when insurance carriers are dropping people left and right for even small claims. It helps to have an insurance broker in your corner. And even Dave Taylor, who's the CEO of First Mark, says, hey, I don't even care if it's us. Just find someone.
I really want to encourage folks, don't try to navigate this current market by yourself. Mm-hmm. I believe you need to get with a broker. Okay, obviously I'd love them to come to First Mark, but at a minimum, they need to be with a broker that works with numerous carriers that can give them the advice they need and really help them navigate this right now, because it's complicated.
Yeah, but I will say, as far as brokers go, obviously I'm very partial to First Mark. Mike and I have been members of the First Mark family for about a year. You know, I heard our friend Dory and others talk about First Mark on the radio for so long before doing it. And I'm just disappointed I waited, because we got better insurance for the same price. And the customer service is second to none. You really do feel like you have someone in your corner to make sure you're getting the best insurance you need at the best price. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Take the First Mark Challenge today. All right. Democrats who support the Climate Commitment Act are absolutely desperate. They are using every tool at their disposal to try to make sure that voters don't repeal the CCA in November. We've talked about some of those things. On the show yesterday, we talked about how Bill Gates, one of the world's richest men, put $1 million into the effort to try to keep the CCA on the books, a rich guy trying to keep your gas prices high. Imagine that. We talked about how during this past legislative session, Democrats approved payoffs to voters right before the November election, literally $200 checks, CCA refunds that are going to go to voters right before the November election. It's just a bribe to try to get them not to repeal the CCA. And now our friend Todd Myers over at the Washington Policy Center is letting us in on another way that taxpayer funds are being used to try to bribe voters into rejecting the CCA repeal. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Boop, 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 boop. Okay, Todd Myers always has the good stuff. He's always paying attention to these little things that are happening on environmental policy. And of course, like us, he's been tracking some of the ways in which Governor Jay Inslee and his buddies are trying to, I think, abuse the system to keep the CCA in place, to improperly influence voters ahead of November. So one of the ways is those payoffs. But Todd Myers just dropped a story for Washington Policy Center, and it focuses on this website. It is a state website. It says Washington Climate Action. And basically what the purpose of this site is a guide to entities that are benefiting from CCA money. And as part of getting money from the Climate Commitment Act, which is just your money that you pay at the gas pump, part of getting that money is they have an obligation to make sure everyone knows where the money came from, and to make sure everyone knows how great the Climate Commitment Act is. The website literally says, to strengthen public awareness of how Climate Commitment Act funding is put to work, state agencies and recipients of programs or projects funded by the CCA are directed to use a funding acknowledgement and or logo. Directed. So this is not optional. This is mandatory. That if you're getting CCA money, you are directed by the state of Washington and Governor Jay Inslee to make sure that you display loud and proud a logo and or an acknowledgement of the wonderful CCA that has brought this money to you. And it's really nefarious, as Todd dives into it. I'm just going to read a couple pieces of his story he published at Washington Policy Center. I encourage you to read the whole thing. He says, as Washington's CO2 tax, known as the Climate Commitment Act, heads to the ballot this fall, a logo highlighting projects that received funding from that tax will become more prevalent. And you are paying for it, he writes. The use of taxpayer resources to promote the CO2 tax follows the decision by the legislature to send one-time checks of $200 to utility customers funded by the Climate Commitment Act just 2 months before the November election. It is part of a pattern we are likely to see accelerate as the vote on Initiative 2117, which would repeal the CO2 tax, draws near. So he says, you know, you got this website, they've got this logo. If you get funds, you've got to put the logo up. But as Todd goes on to write, it isn't just the logo. Organizations are required to use overtly political language on their websites, press releases, publications, and any media or public outreach. So he says, after acknowledging that the state provided the money, organizations are required to include, quote, the CCA supports Washington's climate action efforts by putting cap and invest dollars to work, reducing climate pollution, creating jobs, and improving public health. Information about the CCA is available at climate.wa.gov. So you've got, I mean, this is propaganda. This is absolutely propaganda. If you're benefiting from the CCA in getting climate funds, you got to put the logo and then you have to say or write that exact line. That's government propaganda, black and white. And as Todd notes, he says, contrary to the claims that the money from the CO2 tax is being used to reduce carbon emissions, most of the money thus far has been spent expanding government and subsidizing special interest groups. And that's spot on. That's exactly what this is about. Ask them, challenge them to show you tangible outcomes from the CCA thus far. Tangible outcomes in improving the climate and environment. They can't. They're giving a lot of this money to their cronies. Bottom line, and they're doing some things, as we've discussed on the show before, shutting down parts of working forests in the name of climate justice and in a way that's going to make sure that those forests actually sequester less carbon as time goes on. Oh yeah, great. Great place to spend the CCA money. So this is wild. You think about all this, and Todd's right. This is only going to accelerate. This is going to be in your face everywhere you turn. Lies about, oh, how great the CCA is. Lies like Marco Elias is spreading, Senator Marco Elias, about, oh, that critical transportation project near you? Oh, that'll lose its funding if you repeal the CCA. It's not true. Don't believe it. Oh, we can't repair bridges and roads if you repeal the CCA. That's not true. Don't believe it. Oh, we're going to use government money to write taxpayers a $200 refund check for the CCA right before the election. That timing's not coincidental, not at all. Don't fall for it. Oh, we're going to see all these entities with their Climate Commitment Act logo talking about how great the Climate Commitment Act is for jobs, improving public health, reducing climate pollution. That's government propaganda. Ignore it. And what do we say? Vote yes, pay less. If you vote yes, you'll pay less. You see how easy our messaging is? We don't need lies. We don't need taxpayer funds to prop up our messages. We don't need fear-mongering. We just need the truth. And the truth is that if you vote yes, you'll pay less. So keep that in mind. All right, coming up next, we're going to dip outside of Washington State. We have an update on that NPR story, the NPR whistleblower who says NPR is hopelessly biased. Well, he is now on a 5-day suspension. We'll get some of the reaction from within NPR about what Yuri Berlinger did in an article in the Free Press. First, if you are thinking about selling your home at any point this year, the very best thing that you can do is get an early start on finding out what you need to do in terms of renovations to your home, cosmetic updates, finding out what is my home likely to sell for, and just reduce the stress from the home selling process. Start by visiting sellwithwes.com. Talk to our friend Wes Jones. He'll give you a free market analysis so you can see how well your home is positioned. And they'll talk about some of the unique services that they offer that you're not going to find with other real estate agents. And then there's this issue of rates. You know, the Fed was saying going into this year, we're going to drop rates. Well, that has not manifested. In fact, rates have ticked up a little bit, although Wes Jones does believe that as we get closer to the election, the Fed will feel some pressure to make good on those promises. if they drop interest rates, that's going to be a nice little rush, right?
It is. Yeah. It is. I mean, we're having a rush right now. And when rates drop, you know, assuming that they do, it's going to pick up, you know, even more. And if you want to take advantage of that, it's probably a great time to start that conversation right now. You know, whether you want to sell in the later in the spring, sometime in the summer, or even the fall. If you want to sell in 2024, you know, we're here to start a conversation with you.
Yep. So start early, reduce some of the stress, maybe get some of those cosmetic updates going. In fact, Wes Jones and his team can help you pay for them up front, which is really cool. Then you can pay them back on the back end once you sell your home. So sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Make sure you start by using their home value calculator right there on the website. Just plug in your address, find out how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, dipping outside of Washington State, we talked earlier this week. I lose track of my days. I'm building up to vacation, which I desperately need. And I don't know what happened when. Was this week? Was it last week? I don't know.
I think we started the story last week, but then we updated it yesterday.
Yes.
Now we're updating it again.
So I love the Free Press. I've already said that. They posted an op-ed from a guy named Yuri Berliner, who is a 25-year veteran of NPR. And he came out and said, basically, NPR has lost America's trust. Here's how that happened. And he detailed a lot of examples behind the scenes of stories in recent years that NPR has either gotten completely wrong, has ignored because it wasn't politically popular to cover them, and has just become really a arm of the Democratic Party, and particularly an arm of progressives. And he did his research, too. I mean, he talked about it from his perspective as an editor, where, you know, he was frustrated with the unwillingness to even dive into the possibility of the lab leak theory. He was frustrated with the unwillingness to treat the Hunter Biden laptop story as potentially legitimate. He was frustrated with their coverage of Russian collusion. And then when that, you know, proved not to be true, NPR didn't do a mea culpa. So he detailed all of these things. And then he said of their editors in Washington, D.C., there's 87 of them. 87 of them are registered Democrats, not a single registered Republican. So he expressed concern with what he really saw as a lack of diversity of thought and diversity of opinion that would lead to better journalism at NPR. And it's not like he just chose to speak out about this in the Free Press. No, he'd been trying to raise alarm bells internally for years to no avail. So he published this article. It went absolutely gangbusters on social media. Well, now he's serving a 5-day suspension, which, you know, I gotta be honest, I kind of think that's fair. Mm-hmm. I kind of think that's fair. He didn't get fired. I think NPR knows that that would have been, the backlash against that would have been pretty extreme. So apparently they handed down a 5-day suspension without pay. And NPR reported on that. The headline, NPR suspends veteran editor as it grapples with his public criticism. So the 5-day suspension without pay, they write, began on Friday. In presenting Berliner's suspension Thursday afternoon, the organization told the editor he had failed to secure its approval for outside work for other news outlets, as is required of NPR journalists. It called the letter a final warning, saying Berliner would be fired if he violated NPR's policy again. Berliner is a dues-paying member of NPR's newsroom union, but says he is not going to appeal the punishment. And then NPR got into this, you know, they interviewed other NPR folks, which one of the things I think is funny about these quotes is they don't name them. Well, some of them, they just like, oh, there's these, you know, they use unnamed sources within NPR, which I also think is very unjournalistic. Like, he put his name on his opinions about what's happening at NPR. So if they want to put their name on their opinions, they should feel confident to do that. It says several NPR journalists told me they are no longer willing to work with Berliner, as they no longer have confidence that he will keep private their internal musings about stories as they work through coverage. So they just can completely, as a taxpayer-funded entity, drop the ball on things, and they're expecting that to just totally remain internal, and they're not going to work with him. And then there was a tweet put out by NPR political correspondent Daniel Kurtzblen, who basically said that Berliner has lost all trust within NPR. Newsrooms run on trust. If you violate everyone's trust by going to another outlet and essing on your colleagues while doing a bad job journalistically, for that matter, I don't know how you do your job now. Here's what I find interesting about this. It seems like a lot of these NPRers are more concerned with being exposed than they are with actually contemplating the issues that he brought up. And this is a problem that is widespread in mainstream media today. It's one of my fundamental criticisms of the press. Their job, for that matter, whether you're a political commentator or whether you're a journalist, Our job revolves around, every single day, 100% of the time, criticizing things that other people do. That is the job, and that is supposed to be the job. We criticize people in power, we critique people who do things that are wrong, who commit crimes, or whatever it is. And so we are, in a way, sort of a judge and jury when we put out information criticizing what other people do. It is the job, though. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But it is awful interesting that when you're in a job that requires that of you every single day, and that you have that power and that influence, there is no other entity that is more offended by being criticized themselves than the media. Like, we can criticize all of these people and critique all these people, but oh, God forbid anyone wants to critique what we're doing. God forbid anyone wants to criticize what we're doing. I mean, how sanctimonious is that? How backward is that? The media demands transparency and accountability of everyone else, but not themselves? How can you trust a media outlet that demands transparency and accountability of everyone else, that criticizes everyone else when they fall short of what they're supposed to do, of their obligations, of their expectations? But then when you turn the tables on them and you ask them to look internally at what they're doing, they're mortified by it. They're totally thin-skinned, cannot accept critiques and criticism. I mean, I look back to, we did last week or the week before, we criticized some Cairo radio reporting. And there were some Cairo radio staffers who were losing their minds on Twitter over it. And it's like, dude, I'm criticizing, you did a story criticizing someone else's work, a volunteer helping with homelessness, but you're not allowed to be criticized? You're not allowed to be scrutinized? One of the fundamental issues with the media right now, they are incapable of accepting criticism. They are incapable of believing that they can fall short. I've said it a million times. The reporters you can't trust are the ones who don't admit when they did something wrong, don't admit when they got a fact wrong, or don't believe that there's any way they could possibly do their job better. Those are the reporters, journalists, media outlets that you should just distance yourself from. How many times have I had to correct errors on this show? At least a handful. I mean, I like to think I don't get things wrong very often. I when I was at Fox 13, I remember one time I had to correct the record on something and it sucked bad. But if you're not willing to do that, then you're not worth anything journalistically. Then people can't trust what you say if they don't know that on the back end, when you get something wrong, that you're going to let them know about it. So NPR, shameful. Shameful, the meltdown within NPR. How dare he tell people exactly what we did and said? Well, maybe you should be more concerned about what you did and said than about some guy telling other people about it. All right, this is fascinating. Is this even true? I would assume it's true if RFK put it out, but I just, so we're talking, you know, everybody's like, who's Donald Trump going to pick for his vice president? Who's it going to be? You know, we've talked on this show about who people prefer. RFK Jr. says that Trump sought him for VP.
I mean, I think it's kind of genius.
I don't hate it. Mm-hmm. I just am kind of surprised by it. He says, President Trump calls me an ultra-left radical. I'm so liberal that his emissaries asked me to be his VP. I respectfully declined the offer. I am against President Trump, and President Biden can't win. Judging by his new website, it looks like President Trump knows who can actually beat him. So he's saying this in response to Trump amping up his criticism of RFK Jr., which I think shows what I said on the show yesterday, which I think people are like, oh, RFK Jr. will take more votes away from Biden. I totally disagree. I think he would take more votes away from Donald Trump. Donald Trump probably recognizes that. So he's on the offensive against RFK Jr., which I think is fascinating considering he's an independent candidate. And then RFK is like, if I'm so bad, why do you want me to be your VP? So if he's telling the truth, that is quite interesting. But I think
also, although I think that's a compromise, right?
Yeah. But also Trump is known for using people when it's advantageous to him, you know, and then dropping them when it's not, or else vice versa.
I mean, all politicians are.
Not to that extent. I mean, he's pretty vicious.
Maybe not as
like DeSantis.
It just hasn't been highlighted as much.
Like, it's the opposite with DeSantis. It's like, oh, DeSantis is running against me. That's Ron DeSanctimonious, and I'm going to make fun of him till the end of the day. And then it's like, oh, but will you campaign for me?
But do you remember Biden against Kamala and everyone else on the stage? Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing.
That's it's how not it as works. Vicious. I think there's some policy disagreements that creative. Always come up. More creative. Funny.
Funny, usually.
Funny. But I'm just saying, like, I use the example of let's be honest about it. Him attacking people's wives.
Oh, yeah. And then ridiculous.
It goes beyond a line of personal and policy disagreements.
I'm not defending it. I'm just saying politics is ugly. And I think it'd be fun to watch somebody not treat it that way, but I don't. I mean, I guess nobody's willing to take that risk because they think they can't win without being like nasty.
Yeah, I mean, he takes there's always going to be every debate stage there's ever been for a presidential primary for Democrats and Republicans. There's always been internal personal attacks, and then at the end of the day, they act like it never happened. 100% happens to Democrats and Republicans. I just think it's another level when like you attack someone's wife and their appearance. And then you turn around and act like it didn't happen. Sorry. If you attack my husband, you're dead to me. You're absolutely dead to me. If you were to verbally attack my husband, you're dead to me.
Yep.
So anyway, that's what RFK said, which I thought was interesting. Now, in Trump's defense today, so I've already said, you know, the amount that they resurrected, the media, these left prosecutors, they resurrected Trump's campaign from the ashes. I really think that Ron DeSantis would have been handed the baton and this time last year, you know, was on the upswing. And then the prosecutors started going after Trump and the party, and a lot of Americans who aren't Republicans were like, dude, let it go. And it sort of made him this martyr. And now people are like, nope, that's our guy. And I got to say, what this judge is doing in New York in one of the many trials that Trump has, it honestly, I think it's going to endear a lot of people to the former president. So Trump's in the middle of this hush money trial, which, and there's all these conversations about, can he get a fair trial in New York? Which probably not. The judge might force him to skip his son Barron's high school graduation, which is so genuinely messed up.
Yeah.
So this is from New York Post. Trump fumes that judge in hush money trial could force him to skip his son Barron's graduation. Trump's attorney had asked Justice Juan Merchan not to hold the trial on Friday, May 17th, so the ex-president can attend Barron's graduation at Oxbridge Academy in Palm Beach, Florida. But Merchan was noncommittal. It really depends, he said, on if we are on time and where we are in the trial. Which it's like, okay, the guy's got to, I know he can hop on a private jet and get places quicker than most from New York. But we're not talking about a guy here who's on trial for murder and is currently incarcerated and wants to, you know, be released temporarily so that they can go to their son's graduation. No, we're talking about someone who's already across the country campaigning and he's not asking a lot. Like, he wants to go to his kid's graduation. It only happens once in their lifetime. And so whether this is in line with how a judge might act in other cases, honestly, I don't know. All I know is that this makes me feel bad for Donald Trump. Wow. It makes me feel bad for Barron. And I think that it's going to have that effect on a lot of other people too. It just seems like they are just out to make his life absolutely miserable. And it just doesn't come across very well. Fair.
I heard a couple of people suggest this, but if he was to go and get arrested going to his kid's graduation, are you telling me that that's not going to help him? That would not hurt him.
Well, and it's like, why can't he miss trial? He can't be...
It's kind of ridiculous. He's already been sitting there falling asleep while they're picking jurors. Like, how boring would that be, sitting in there every day, all day?
And I think it was CNN or MSNBC. Were you playing me this clip when they were talking about Donald Trump appeared to be nodding off, and then all of a sudden he wasn't, and then he was, and then he wasn't, and then he wasn't. It's like, you guys are unhinged.
They're going through 96 people and saying, can you be non-partial or whatever it is? Can you
jury selection.
Yeah. And, like, how could you stay awake during that?
I couldn't even stay awake through that. Oh, my gosh. There's times, not during the show, but sometimes, like, when I'm taping things where I'm, like,
goodness
swallowing.
Gracious.
And also, if CNN or I can't remember if it was CNN or MSNBC. They're the same thing, honestly. If they can spend that much time talking about whether Donald Trump was or was not nodding off during jury selection, there's a lot of similar issues you could discuss with President Joe Biden as well. Mm-hmm. So it's all just biased nonsense. It's ridiculous. And that's no commentary from me on whether, you know, he should be found guilty in this trial or not. But there's just a lot of things that have galvanize Donald Trump in a way that I feel like is the reverse of the intent that they're trying to like shut him down. Okay, we're going to get to your questions and comments in our daily show poll coming up next. First, we asked our friend Zach Abraham about an article that came out recently. You might have seen it. It was an annual study done by Northwestern Mutual where they ask Americans, how much money do you think you need to retire? Have you considered that? How much money in your brain you think you need to comfortably retire? And the average number this year is 1.46 million. The thing that's interesting about that is it's up 53% from 2020. So in 2020, Americans thought they needed $951,000 to retire comfortably. Now it's 1.46 million. I asked Zach Abraham whether we should really read into that figure.
You know, an average number that we throw out there like that is complete nonsense. For some people, that number is 500,000. For some people, the number might be 3 million. We're talking about what it takes to fund you over a 25 to 30 year period of time. Truthfully, that bump 53%, it does not even begin to incorporate what the actual cost is extrapolated over a 25-year period of time. So,
right,
like I said, you may need less. More than likely, you're probably going to need more.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. It's like, I'd rather have too much than too little. And I know it's stressful to plan for retirement and inflation. And what is that money going to get me in 20 or 30 years when I retire? A really good thing to do right now with the election, with all this nonsense happening with the economy, gaslighting to make you believe the economy is good when it's really, really not. I suggest having a free Know Your Risk portfolio review with Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital. This is what they specialize in: protecting your retirement, actively managing your risk. It's just a great way to see if you're overexposed to risk. There's absolutely no obligation for the portfolio review. So you can schedule your free risk review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. All right, before we get to questions and comments, how about we get to answers in our daily subscriber show poll, shall we? Because I asked you guys, you know, we mentioned earlier the blockades that have happened. Interstate, bridge, airport, and how in Olympia there was a bipartisan effort among just a couple Democrats, but we'll still call it bipartisan. It was a Republican bill to make it a Class C felony to organize one of these protests. But I asked you guys, do you think it should be a felony just to participate, not just to organize? But I said, do you believe it should be a felony offense in Washington state to block transportation, so roads, bridges, public transit, as part of a peaceful demonstration? So I would say, even though it's annoying, they weren't being violent. They were peacefully sitting there like losers. Fawn Spady says, hi, Fawn. Oh my gosh, I haven't heard from you in so long. Mandatory 30-day jail time and fine of up to $500. A lot of you are saying yes, although there is a little bit of disagreement in there. Curtis Tucker says, if they're refusing to prosecute a clear misdemeanor, why would they prosecute a felony? That's a good question. I mean, but are the tides turning on that? Because you had the arrests that happened after the fact on the I-5 thing. It seems like they're pursuing those charges. So if the political tides turn a little bit, yeah, I think they'd prosecute a felony. Let me see here. Daniel says, we should not be tolerating these types of soft terrorism. There needs to be consequences for these people, not just a slap on the wrist. I'm surprised the stern tone from Bob Ferguson in response to the airport block, probably saving face because election season, which was much better than the soft milk toast response from Dave Reichert. Whoever's running Reichert's social media needs to do better. It's very pathetic. Yeah, I thought his statement could have been better. Look, here's the thing about it though. And I support Dave, so maybe this is me getting a little defensive. Dave Reichert is running to win in November. And other candidates are running to win in the primary or running to win a party nomination. And one of the things Dave Reichert knows is he needs to appeal to moderate Democrats. He needs to appeal to independents. And so I think that's what you're seeing in that soft sort of, hey, I respect people. What he said basically is, I respect people's First Amendment rights, but we can't have this. We can't have this, what, you know, blockade and ruining people's lives and intervening in people's lives. So, yeah, I mean, I do kind of agree that on its face, Bob Ferguson's statement was a little stronger, calling it unacceptable. But Bob Ferguson is also just a liar and he doesn't care at all. And he's never spoken out about stuff like this. And at least Dave has. Ricky says, disgusting, but likely truth. It's going to take a death of someone trapped by one of these protests to get things changed. Yeah, that's possible, but I think that's happened before. Thomas Wells says someone died when they blocked roads during BLM. Nothing changed to discourage this. They're just more emboldened. Well, I blame politicians, but really it's the fault of voters, honestly. Not us, of course. We're very sensical, but it's voters who continue to elect politicians like Bob Ferguson, like Jay Inslee, giving Jay Inslee another term after he denied even knowing about CHOP and then said he did know about it, giving Bob Ferguson more terms after all these things happen, he never says anything about it. So ultimately, it comes down to voters. Okay, other questions and comments. On the protesters, Aaron Fry says, Sideshow Bob is a day late and a dollar short. How quick do you think he'll be to prosecute any of these domestic terrorists? Yeah, and I don't think it would be his purview to prosecute them, but him speaking out about it does make a difference. Had he been speaking out about every one of these acts of clear disruptive civil unrest, criminal unrest for the last few years, you really think that it would be tolerated to the extent that it is right now? Absolutely not. But he couldn't do that because he had to kowtow to the Democratic Socialists, kowtow to the progressives. Kenneth says, blocking infrastructure should be treated as domestic terrorism. Rubber bullets, shotgun, beanbag rounds, and water cannons would stop that right quick. Bill, how can people not see Ferguson's response to the terrorist takeover at SeaTac as anything but campaign blather, yet his voters will choose not to? Yeah, I agree. On Ian Golosh, Todd Welch says, SPS will conduct a lackluster investigation. The teacher will be on paid leave, and then he will be cleared after the school year. They may find a reason not to bring him back next year. It does bother me that he's being paid. But that's a union for you, and they have those union protections in place. But it's not like an innocent till proven guilty. He willingly went on camera and said what he said. Now we have to go through this government red tape bureaucracy union process where all of it's hidden from us behind the scenes, and he gets to be paid. You know what he's going to be doing? Do you know what he's going to be doing while he's out on paid leave? He's going to be committing acts of civil unrest as he has been. He's going to be out doing things like this. I mean, he's not supposed to contact students with SPS while he's out. But every time he's out doing these things, during that interview, he was with students. In 2020, when he was blocking news cameras, he was with students leading a protest into the King County Jail. Man can't stay away from kids. That sounded nefarious, but honestly, he can't stay away from kids and influencing them to be little activists. He
really likes to influence kids.
Yeah, he really does. It's really weird. Liz says, now that Ian Golosh has time on his hands, he can go to Gaza and support them in person. Yes. You know what, Liz? Should we start a GoFundMe? Send Ian Golosh to Gaza? I feel like we could raise enough money very, very quickly. On the vax bus that's at the state capitol right now, Mary Christie says, allergic reactions to prescription medication is very real too. I know firsthand, and I think there's this idea through this whole initiative to understand that we can't believe what these huge, you know, the big pharma tells us. And the left used to be very skeptical of big pharma. And then COVID happened, and now the left's like doing commercials for big pharma. It's super strange. Mm-hmm. And so now it's like the right that's skeptical of big pharma. But we should all be skeptical of what we're putting into our body, of the reasons. And I'm not anti-vax by any stretch of the imagination. Besides, I mean, I got the COVID vaccine. I didn't get the boosters because I was duped into believing that the vaccine would protect me from getting COVID or giving COVID, and it did not. So I didn't get the follow-ups. So I'm not anti-vax, but when you're putting anything in your body, when it's coming from a company that's making billions and billions of dollars off of hawking those prescription drugs and getting doctors to choose their prescriptions to give to their patients, of course you need to be skeptical of it. You need to have a doctor that you trust to make sure that they're suggesting the right things and not just writing prescriptions because that's what they've been told to do.
And I think it's just, it's about making sure that it's okay to question things like that, to question the vaccine, say, hey, is it right for me because of all these conditions? But you weren't allowed to question it. You weren't allowed to have doubts. You weren't allowed. And it was very clear that the government was saying, you're not allowed to have that criticism. You're not allowed.
Yeah,
and
can't on social media. Right. You'd be flagged as misinformation.
Right, which makes you skeptical of everything. So I'm not saying obviously not all medicines are bad. All medicines, a lot of medicines save lives, quite clearly. But the fact that we're kind of muffling which ones are okay to talk about, which ones are not, it's not okay. And so I think I like what they're doing and just saying, hey, we just want to be okay with talking about it.
Right. And that's because I asked, you know, are you anti the COVID vaccine? And he said, no, it's just about making sure that people are making informed decisions and they can, like you said, ask questions, have criticisms or whatever it is of government mandates and not be attacked for it.
And if they have a story, like I got sick or this happened to me after I got vaccinated, right. Why don't we look at the issue and see if they're connected? But instead you're not allowed to say that this happened after this. It was not caused. You're crazy.
Right. Well, it's like my mom. She got the vaccine and she goes out to dinner, comes home, mm-hmm. wakes up several minutes later with a big goose egg, puke all around her in her bathroom.
I don't even think I knew this story.
Did you? No, my mom got very sick from the COVID vaccine. And so it's like stuff like that. Yeah, we should be talking about that because my mom could have mm-hmm. died from hitting her head and falling.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so scary. Not from COVID, but from hitting her head and falling. Mm-hmm. And that was almost more dangerous. All right. Let me see. On Trump, Matt Gilbert says Trump is the moderate candidate.
It might be true.
Moderacy always depends on who you're comparing someone to.
Yeah, but I think that he's saying common sense things that you say all the time, yep. and he's just labeled as crazy right wing. And I think that is what's happening, is that he is the more moderate, considering the Bidens of the world are grouping themselves in with these people that are not at all moderate. And then there's RFK.
Yeah. Well, and he also has moderated his position on abortion. Trump has talking about how, no, we should leave that to the states, which is absolutely what baffles me about the abortion conversation with some conservatives is they now want to seize on the repeal of Roe v. Wade mm-hmm. to do some sort of national ban. And it's like, you guys have been fighting for years to get the issue sent back to the states because it's not a protection in the Constitution, which it's not. So it's not even constitutionally sound to want to then, as Congress, try to litigate the issue. It's just weird to me. So it's like, you got what you wanted. Leave it alone. Let it be in the states. Let people, if they really need to move somewhere based on needing an abortion, let them do it, weirdos.
I just can't believe it's still a thing.
It really is. It's mm-hmm. bad. Kathy says, in case you didn't know, Brandy's hair dryer is on sale at Costco, although my hair is terrible today because I ran out of time and it's frizzy and it's not the fault of the wonderful shark. Not the shark. Which one did I buy?
Shark.
Is it shark? Oh, yeah. It's not the fault of the shark dryer that my hair is frizzy. Mm-hmm. I just waited too long to do my hair. I was on the phone with someone. But yes, it's on sale at Costco. One more on the CCA. Desiree Andrada says of the Climate Commitment Act bribery to try to get you not to repeal it. They create fake catastrophes that none of us can prove just so they can pass laws, money grabs, and seize more power. It's all a scam. Yeah, it is the climate industrial complex. There are things we can and should do to make sure that we protect this wonderful planet of ours. But you're telling me that the only way to do that is for working class people to go broke? I just don't buy into that. I think that's ridiculous. Okay, good comments per the usual. Let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? We've talked a lot about the low bail, low standards, no accountability for juvenile offenders. And I even recall a court hearing where there had been a drive-by shooting and the 15-year-old was baffled that he wasn't going to be let home on electronic house arrest because his buddy, was also a fellow gangbanger and he was just like, oh my God, I got bail. That doesn't make any sense. I thought the system was designed to, let me off the hook. So anyway, this is from King 5 News. A 16-year-old, this is why we don't put people on home monitoring when they have shown that they have a propensity to commit violent crimes. 16-year-old was on home monitoring when he allegedly shot and killed a teen in Renton, according to prosecutors. And again, that's not a surprise to me because you really think electronic home monitoring, you have someone sitting there monitoring your location 24 hours a day. No, you can easily break electronic home monitoring. Are you going to get in trouble for it later? Probably. But if you really want to go out and shoot someone, you're going to do it anyway. It says the 16-year-old suspected of shooting and killing a 15-year-old in Renton over the weekend was on electronic home monitoring for an alleged drive-by about 5 months prior, according to prosecutors. Shortly after 4 p.m. on Saturday, the 16-year-old called 911 and reported to police that he shot someone. According to the Renton Police Department, the shooting took place in a home. At the home, officers found a 15-year-old boy with life-threatening injuries from the shooting. Police said he was taken to Harborview Medical Center. He died from his injuries that Sunday. They're working to determine if or how the two teens knew each other. Authorities did not say if the shooting was accidental or deliberate. So yeah, he's at home on home monitoring, still shoots and kills a 15-year-old. Playing with guns, yeah. So keep him in jail.
And he asked to be released on home monitoring again. Luckily, yeah. The judge said, not this time.
Okay, good. All right. There's our sanity check for today. All right. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense Come Back. We appreciate every single one of you. If you haven't signed up to support our show already, wonderful time to do it. You can help us pay for this new studio remodel that we're going to be broke after. But, you know, $5 a month on DividedPod.com. OnDividedPod.com. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.